From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, US warplanes pound ISIS militant targets with a second round of strikes as the White House insists US combat troops won't be going back into Iraq.
There is support that can be provided by the American military, but this is a situation that will only be solved by the Iraqi people. And a government that reflects the views of Iraq's diverse population.
Also today, Hamas rockets are once again fired at Israel as a 72-hour truce between the warring sides comes to an end. And Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius's defense team says the state was wrong to charge the athlete with premeditated murder.
This allegation of a premeditated or a dolus directus, that is so contrary to what I see. It does not make sense.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Pentagon has confirmed that the U.S. has conducted additional airstrikes against Islamist militant group ISIS. Overnight, the U.S. started operations to support the Kurdish Peshmerga, dropping two 500-pound laser-guided bombs on ISIS artillery positions outside Erbil, the capital of the Kurdistan Regional Government. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has this update.
The Pentagon confirms a drone targeted an ISIL mortar position near Erbil, quote, successfully eliminating the terrorists. And four F-A-18 aircraft made a series of passes to drop a total of eight bombs on targets neutralizing an Islamic militant mortar position and a related convoy. White House spokesman Josh Earnest says U.S. President Barack Obama has given U.S. Central Command orders to conduct airstrikes in Iraq as needed.
He will not be in a situation where he is signing off on individual strikes, but there will be regular consultation from the president's military commanders to their commander-in-chief.
Additionally, the UK's defense secretary has announced there will be a British aid drop for members of the Yazidi community in Iraqi Kurdistan. Here's Natalie Powell from London.
Following in the footsteps of their American counterparts, the UK is now preparing for an RAF aid drop over the next couple of days. The Yazidi community is under threat from militants in Iraq as fighting intensifies. Many are stranded on Mount Sinjar, threatened by slaughter if they move. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has welcomed US airstrikes against the Islamic State militants, but says the UK will not follow suit.
Meanwhile, rockets have once again been fired from Gaza at Israel after a three-day ceasefire expired. Palestinian militant group Hamas is for now rejecting an extension of the truce, saying Israel has failed to meet demands such as the reopening of Gaza Harbor to shipping. Around 1,940 people have died in 4 weeks of fighting in Gaza. The World Health Organization has declared an international health emergency over the spread of the Ebola virus in West Africa. The decision comes after experts held an emergency meeting in Switzerland. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
The World Health Organization says containing the Ebola virus is of utmost importance following the deaths of more than 930 people in West Africa this year. Health experts have urged affected countries to stop those infected and those in contact with the virus from traveling, but stopped short of issuing an outright travel or trade ban to the region. Since Ebola broke out in Guinea in March, it's since spread to Sierra Leone and Liberia and has a 55% to 60% death rate. Critics say international intervention so far in West Africa has not worked to contain the spread of Ebola, but the WHO insists ringing a global alarm bell now will urge those infected to seek treatment sooner.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Closing arguments have finished in the murder trial of South African Paralympian Oscar Pistorius. Mr. Pistorius is accused of intentionally shooting and killing his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, while the athlete claims her death was an accident as he mistook her for an intruder. A verdict is now expected on the 11th of September. Gary Alfonso reports.
The bulk of defense attorney Barry Roos' closing revolved around the timeline of testimony by Pistorius and all the witnesses. He said the judge must consider that the sequence of events, loud women-like screams, loud bangs, and the time witnesses reported they heard them was consistent with Pistorius' testimony. Roos said Pistorius could not be found guilty for murder because his actions immediately after the shooting depicted those of someone who wanted to save his girlfriend. He emphasized that police investigators compromised the scene of the crime. Judge Stokozile Masipa will hand down a verdict on September 11th.
The UN Security Council says South Sudan has reached the threshold of a famine after months of instability. In a statement, the body said it would consider sanctions against those perceived to be undermining peace. From New York, Daniel Wrenches reports.
For months, President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar have been locked into a political struggle that's turned violent. The UN Security Council statement says there have been gross violations of human rights, including rape, the use of children in conflict, as well as attacks on schools, hospitals and UN personnel. The statement calls on the two leaders to urgently engage in peace talks and the formation of a unity government, and says targeted sanctions are now being considered at a time when there is concern about what the UN Security Council calls a catastrophic food insecurity situation that may soon reach the threshold of famine.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. US warplanes have pounded ISIS targets with a second round of strikes in northern Iraq.
We do remain concerned about the military proficiency that's been demonstrated by ISIL, and it's why you've seen the president take steps, including the authorization of military force, that would protect American citizens who might be harmed by ISIL.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest after U.S. jets dropped their first laser-guided bombs on ISIS artillery near Erbil in the country's north. President Obama had earlier announced that airstrikes against the militant group would be used to protect U.S. personnel and facilities, but insisted American troops on the ground wasn't an option. Humanitarian airdrops were also given the green light by the Obama administration to help thousands of Iraqis who fled the ISIS surge, only to be stranded in desperate need of food, water and medical supplies. Mohammed Salah is a freelance journalist in Erbil, the regional capital of Iraqi Kurdistan.
Erbil city itself has been quite safe, and there has not been really any problems inside Erbil city proper. Today I went to the front line just around 40 miles or so northwest of Erbil, around the town of Mahmur, and there was some fighting going on there. There was the sound of, shelling by heavy weaponry, and there seemed to be quite some clashes going on in that area, but as far as Erbil city itself is concerned, it is quite safe, at least so far.
Why do you think, Mohammed, that the United States took action now?
The Kurdish government and leadership definitely pressed Washington and also other Western nations very hard to basically offer them support and assistance. Let's not forget that it was actually France. President François Hollande of France was the first Western head of state who came out with a statement publicly supporting Kurdish Peshmerga's fight against ISIS and offering to provide assistance. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters said, the one that we were talking to today, they were quite happy about it, and they said it was actually a bit that they decided to support a bit late. They should have supported a bit earlier. But let's not also forget about what's at the stake. ISIS is a very brutal, radical, extremist force. It's a kind of force that really no one in Kurdistan, Iraq, or in the broader world can have much sympathy for. And we have seen how this group acts in any area that they control. They usually go after the minorities, slaughter them or displace them from their homes and damage the cultural and historical heritage of the areas that they have controlled. So for Kurdistan right now, it's a real war. As I said at the beginning, it's a full-scale war, and the Kurdish Peshmerga forces were very vital in the U.S. campaign back in 2003 to remove Saddam Hussein from power, and they expect a mutual help from the United States.
And Mohammed, what can you tell us about the Peshmerga fighters? We understand that they've suffered some fairly heavy fatalities this week.
Well, the Peshmerga forces do not really put out numbers when it comes to their casualties. And it has been always a very, very difficult task to try to get any numbers from them regarding the, you know, the number of their casualties. But today the conditions I saw on the ground, they really had high morals, and they were fighting alongside other Kurdish forces.
But in terms of the theatre of this conflict, those fighters, who are a formidable force, they are, however, being stretched, aren't they, across many fronts in this conflict with ISIS fighters?
They are certainly very much stretched thin. They are fighting in almost 10 areas and fronts right now, all the way from the Syrian border to the west, down to the Iranian border in the east. So it is a state of full-scale, full-blown war as far as the Kurds are concerned. They have been taking on ISIS forces on multiple fronts, as I said, around 10 of them. So they are being really overwhelmed, and they are trying to maintain ground in the first place. And with the help of the airstrikes from the U.S., and they are hoping to be able to push back the ISIS forces. Today I was speaking to one of the senior field commanders, and he said that they really needed weapons and ammunition. He was again saying that they are fighting on different fronts, but he was quite optimistic at the same time that you know, that they can fight ISIS forces, and he had been taking part in the fighting in that area for a couple of days, and he said from his experience that these fighters could be defeated, but that the Peshmerga need more assistance from the outside world.
You are in Erbil at the moment. How far, can you give us an idea, how far are these Islamic State fighters from your doorstep?
They are around 50 kilometers, 50 to 60 kilometers far from Erbil. And today when I went to that area, the Kurdish forces have basically set up defenses in different parts along the road, the highway that connects Mahmur to Erbil. So, you know, these people are not really very, very far, but it's not that they are also that very close that they could threaten the physical security and safety of Erbil city. But again, they have been a group that have advanced in different parts of the country at a very rapid speed. And the Kurds, you know, have been able to fight and maintain ground in some parts of the country. But it's also very obvious that they are really stretched very thin, and that they need outside assistance and support.
And lastly, Mohammed, John Kerry, the US Secretary of State today, he talked about this campaign of terror against the innocent, and among those, the Yazidi community.
Yes.
Can you explain, because they seem to have, while they may have escaped what sounds like almost certain slaughter, they've now replaced that with starvation and dehydration, terrible conditions for them. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's very obvious from ISIS track record that they have no love lost for anybody who does not subscribe to their worldview, to their ideological perspective of the world. It's not only religious minorities such as the Yazidis or Christians or even different Muslim sects like Shias who have borne the brunt of ISIS's terror is also those Muslims, Sunni Muslims, who do not really subscribe to ISIS's view. So this is a kind of organization that basically has made it very clear right from the beginning that you are either with them or you are against them. And if you are against them, you are going to face any sort of dangerous outcome, and death is definitely one of their most common tactics to scare and terrorize their enemies and force them into surrender. It that those people are on the top of the mountain, they are trapped and they cannot get down because ISIS is positioned around the base of the mountain, and these people do not want to give up their religion, they do not want to surrender to ISIS, so they have preferred to stay there and even starve but not fall into the hands of ISIS. That's why it is so important and so imperative for the outside world, for anyone who can do anything to help these people, to rescue them and to provide shelter.
Freelance journalist Mohammed Salah in Erbil. Now, Washington Bureau Chief The Economist David Rennie, one of the journalists currently travelling with the US Defence Secretary during his trip to India, said Chuck Hagel described the Islamic State surge as a significant threat.
I'm one of the reporters travelling with the American Defence Secretary Chuck Hagel, who is in Delhi at the moment. He told us this afternoon that the Islamic State constitutes a very significant threat to the security and stability of Iraq. What is clear from talking to the American military officers traveling with the defense secretary, he travels essentially with a kind of command center with him in a gigantic Boeing 747. They get constant real-time intelligence. They have updates from 35 American special forces who are in Erbil at the moment working with Kurdish fighters. And it's clear that they are very alarmed by how rapidly the Islamic State fighters have been advancing on Erbil. And it's clear that that is a real trigger point, and that explains why now, after weeks of advances by IS, why now they've been really taking it seriously.
The United States military has begun airstrikes against targets in the north of Iraq, Islamic State fighter targets. Do we have any idea, did you hear from the Secretary of Defense as to the size and potential scope of the US involvement there?
Well, he has had to cancel a dinner tonight in Delhi. He was due to have a big grand dinner with the Indian government. He is now on a secure video conference to the other cabinet secretaries, the principals, and President Obama in the White House. He's doing that from here in Delhi. That's a sense of the crisis that they are in. They have a lot of assets in place. There is an aircraft carrier, the USS George H.W. Bush, which is in the Persian Gulf. They have bases in other Arab countries. They have bases in Turkey. They will not tell us publicly which bases forces are coming from, but they say they have fixed-wing planes ready to go in Erbil in the north, in Baghdad, where the American embassy is also something they said would be a trigger. Any attacks, any sense of a threat towards Baghdad, they would act. At the airport in Baghdad, they have hundreds of special forces. They also have Apache attack helicopters. They're saying that the situation is grave, that the permission has been given for these airstrikes in these limited circumstances, but they're saying they have the assets, and they're saying that if Islamic State fighters move in big numbers, particularly on Erbil at the moment, but also on Baghdad, once they're moving in those sort of numbers, they could be stopped with airstrikes. So they're saying that this is something that airstrikes would be capable of stopping.
And politically, I mean, how popular a decision is this? Because there doesn't seem to be a great deal of domestic opposition nor international criticism for the moves that this administration has taken in the last 24 hours.
I think it depends how long it goes on and how long it lasts. And I suspect one of the big problems will clearly be in terms of American public opinion. Very obvious that the president has been stressing how limited this is, stressing that it's extremely narrow circumstances, protecting Americans on the ground, protecting this very specific refugee crisis on the mountains in Sinjar. But the problem is, they're also saying that the Islamic State now poses a very serious threat to Iraq's overall stability. And when you ask Secretary Hagel, when I asked Secretary Hagel today, does that mean that, you know, even if they don't go into Erbil, there is still a national security threat to America from what's going on? There's a kind of funging. You know, clearly that is the core of the political debate now raging in Washington. You know, is Iraq's stability itself enough of a cause to see more strikes, more action? They're very, very keen not to escalate this. Absolutely adamant there won't be ground troops, no boots on the ground. But I think, you know, they're not fully in control of this process because, you know, in war, the enemy gets a vote.
David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. This is FSN Reports. Hamas rockets are once again being fired at Israel just as a three-day truce between the sides expired. The Israeli military has responded with renewed air attacks on Gaza. Palestinian officials say a boy was killed and six other people injured in an Israeli strike in Gaza City. Ila Lazareva, a journalist and political analyst in Tel Aviv, spoke to LBC earlier.
Yes, the ceasefire has indeed ended. There have been at least four sirens in about 10 minutes in southern Israel. Rockets haven't yet been fired at sort of more central Israeli towns, Tel Aviv and other places. The ceasefire is finished. Hamas is saying it has not been able to, Israel has not acceded to its demands about the lifting the siege on Gaza. This was the main reason for the talks. Now we have rumblings coming out of Cairo, people saying that the Palestinians may still stay in the negotiations along with the Israelis and, of course, the Egyptians in an attempt to try and salvage something from these talks. But for the time being, the rocket fire does continue.
We have seen ominous words from Hamas, meanwhile, as you say, that the war with Israel, it won't be over until the group's demands for lifting of the Gaza blockade are met. I mean, how will ordinary people on both sides be viewing that?
Well, I think the ordinary people on both sides are just generally absolutely fed up with the situation, both in Israel and in particular in Gaza, given the amount of devastation that's caused there. People have just been in Gaza, people have been out on the streets enjoying being outside for the first time in almost a month. And children have been able to go to the beach properly for the first time and so on. In Israel, yes, the situation hasn't been as extreme, but it has hurt the economy. It has stressed many, many people out, having to, two-thirds of the population has been running regularly into bomb shelters at all times, day and night. I think people just want an end to this. Hamas is saying, yes, we want the lifting of the siege. Israel actually has said that it is had to discuss the lifting of the siege on Gaza in return for a demilitarization of the Gaza Strip, something which is obviously very painful for Hamas because they rely a lot on their military prowess to make their demands known.
Ina Lazareva, journalist and political analyst in Tel Aviv, speaking to LBC's Lisa Aziz. Now, Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius's defence team says the state was wrong to charge the athlete with premeditated murder. Mr. Pistorius is accused of the murder of his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, but maintains he mistook her for an intruder. Attorney Barry Rue told the court in closing arguments that the charges were originally based on wrong information compiled by an investigator, Hilton Botha, who was subsequently removed from the case. Prosecutor Harry Nell had earlier accused the track star of a snowball of lies during the case. The judge overseeing the trial indicated that a verdict can be expected on September 11th. FSN's Gary Alfonso has been covering proceedings in South Africa.
Defence attorney Barry Rue used the whole day to argue four or five main points to Judge Tokozile Masipa and really effectively trying to get across four or five points of what the judge should take into consideration when passing verdict, because they felt that there were a few areas where the state's evidence and also the state's arguments were inconsistent with what happened on that night that Reva Steenkamp was shot and killed by Oscar Pistorius. The first one was the timeline, and Barry Rue made a very strong argument and also took a long time to explain to Judge Tokozile Masipa that there was no other plausible explanation for the timeline that all the witnesses gave, and also that of Oscar Pistorius being consistent only with Oscar Pistorius's version. And that is that the the first people woke up, something woke them up at around about 3:12 in the morning, that there were loud bangs at or screaming at around about 3:17, and then loud bangs again at 3:19 in the morning, and then calls to emergency services anywhere between 3:24, 3:27, and 3:30 that morning. And all the eyewitnesses, with the exception of one, whose testimony Barry Roux also spent a long time trying to discredit, saying that that could not be believed because it doesn't fit into even some of the known facts around the case, like at the time at which emergency services arrived, this witness claimed that there were still loud noises happening. So the facts around the timeline in this case are a very strong part of the defense of Barry Roux and his closing arguments today. Another important part of his closing argument was that the police contaminated the scene. And not saying that it was police incompetence or even police collusion or police tampering at the scene, simply saying that perhaps the police officers and investigators at the scene that morning did not understand the full extent to which something as rudimentary as an extension cord and how far an extension cord can lead and how an extension cord was lying in relation to a fan that was taken out onto a balcony or put back into the room could become a part of contention in the evidence between the state and the prosecution, or the state and prosecution and the defense in this case. So saying that there was definitely some contamination of the scene, and also that the police did not disclose all the pictures because in many of the pictures, some of the areas in which Oscar Pistorius might have been blamed for lying were later proved, and the defense saying in this case they proved in one picture that there was actually an extension cord where the police pictures from the investigation showed no extension cord. So the other area is definitely around the behavior of Oscar Pistorius, saying that if the state were to charge Oscar Pistorius with premeditated murder or even murder, it was not consistent with Oscar Pistorius's behavior immediately after the scene or after the event, because witnesses said that Oscar Pistorius was crying, pleading, praying, and calling for help, and that was not consistent with somebody who was trying to kill his girlfriend and trying to get away with the murder. So those areas, the core of the defense's closing arguments today, and Barry Roux, according to many legal experts and even many comments on social media, pulling back the state's lead on what many people felt was a strong evidence against Pistorius, and again pulling back and perhaps balancing the scales as this goes into the deliberation by the judge and her two assessors over the next few weeks.
As you point out, it'll be several weeks before we have a verdict in this trial, but what are the potential outcomes? Can you walk us through those?
The judge and her two assessors will obviously have a major task on their hands to go through the thousands of pages of evidence and also the heads of arguments, which were not disclosed fully in the open court in the past 2 days. That's the legal documents and legal stuff that the judge and her teams will have to unpack over the next few days and weeks. She has indicated that at 9:30 on September 11th, the court will resume again and she will give her verdict. An important point is whether or not the judge will agree with the defense that Oscar Pistorius should have been charged with culpable homicide in the first place and not premeditated murder, because it's not clear whether the initial case that was put forward by the state by a police investigator who was subsequently removed from the case and who the defense wanted back to question and answer those questions, whether the premeditated murder charge that was initially thought should have been brought to the case, that many legal experts say could become one of the crux points of this whole trial, and we'll know on September 11th.
Gary Alfonso in South Africa. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact us, email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter @featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.